This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Welcome to the show. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about capital punishment, particularly here in Illinois. In recent years, the death penalty has become increasingly a topic for debate in this state. Since the death penalty was reinstated here in 1977, 12 men have been executed and another 13 have been exonerated and released from death row. So many questions have been raised about the way that capital cases have been handled that Illinois Governor George Ryan announced a moratorium on executions back in January of 2000. He also appointed a commission to study the system. The governor said that until he could be sure that everyone sentenced to death in Illinois was truly guilty, no one would be put to death. Also, the Illinois Supreme Court appointed a commission to look into the way that the death penalty is administered. The results there have already been made public. The governor's commission has yet to make any formal recommendations. The governor said that one of the reasons for his decision to put this moratorium into effect was some of the reporting that had been done by the Chicago Tribune. And this morning on the program, we have two reporters from the Tribune that did some of these stories that got people talking about the death penalty and thinking about the death penalty, Maurice Possley and Steve Mills. Maurice Possley is a criminal justice reporter for the paper. He's worked for the Tribune for 17 years. Back in 99, he and another reporter co-authored a series, a five-part investigative series, showing how many prosecutors conducted themselves, not in the way that perhaps we would like. That series, along with another on the death penalty in Illinois, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in the public service category. Our other guest, Steve Mills, and he also now for several years has been writing stories about the death penalty. He and another reporter worked on a big series that you might have seen in the paper that ran in the fall of 1999, about 2 years ago. He also, for his work, he's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in reporting. The two of them here visiting the campus, they came down here to spend some time talking with journalism students and were good enough to come and also visit with us. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. I know they'll do their best to answer your questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks to both of you.
It's a pleasure.
For being here. Some of the work I think that both of you have done, looking both at capital cases here in the state of Illinois and elsewhere, suggests that there are certain problems that seem to crop up in a lot of cases, and particularly in some of those cases, those 13 cases where here you had somebody who was on death row, when the features of the case and the way that it was conducted were reviewed, it was discovered that there were difficulties, and in fact, as people will know, a number of people were exonerated and they were released. And maybe we can talk about some of these things in no particular order. Maybe I'll start out here with the issue of the quality of defense. It would seem that if you look at the recommendations that this commission appointed by the Supreme Court has made, that at least those people seem to think that the basic problem is bad lawyering. And what they've done is that they have recommended that there since be a capital bar created, that you want to make sure that attorneys that are representing people who may be facing the death penalty are very well skilled. They have special training in this area. They've done it before. And also there's some concern about the ability of prosecutors and defense attorneys to be able to have expert witnesses and do forensic testing and so forth. That seems to be the thrust so far of the recommendations that have been made.
That's certainly one of the key issues. In the first series that we did about the death penalty in Illinois, we looked at 285 cases, and in 33 of those we found that the defendants had been represented by somebody who had either been suspended or disbarred at one point in their career. And the committees that are looking at the issue have picked up on that. It's something that's easy to grasp, that you should have somebody who knows what they're doing when you walk into the courtroom to defend your life. In some cases, there have been real estate lawyers appointed to cases, probate lawyers, people just out of law school. And it's just the same way that you wouldn't go into surgery necessarily with somebody perhaps just out of medical school doing it on their own. You wouldn't want to go into a courtroom where you're on trial for your life with somebody just out of law school or somebody who doesn't do that kind of work.
It's also a really key component to the overall makeup of a case because when you're a defendant coming in, you've got the juggernaut of the state, okay, that's trying to kill you. And you have the police and whatever investigative agencies that are involved and the prosecutors. And so as a defendant, you want or need someone who's at least going to put them to the test. And you see a lot of the prosecutorial or law enforcement abuses occur in cases where the defense is a no-show, so to speak, where they're not there to kind of make these people toe the line.
And that's something that really has to happen at both ends of a case. I mean, if you're not qualified or not interested in investigating the investigation itself to really test what the witnesses supposedly are going to say, what the evidence supposedly shows, you're not going to be able to do a good job in court. And if you don't test them then in court, if you sort of just lay down and don't really examine the evidence, you're not going to know how good it is and how reliable it is.
Well, look, going back to the 99 series, where at that point there were 12 people that had been exonerated. As I remember, the finding was that in something like four of those cases, there were attorneys who had been or later were disbarred or suspended. So it's not obviously not the only problem. It is a contributing problem. One, if you could look at
It's in a lot of ways it's the key problem because if you don't have an advocate, somebody who will look at the evidence, you don't know if one of the witnesses is a jailhouse snitch, for example, something else that we wrote about. You don't know if the scientific evidence that they bring in is credible, if it was done the right way, if it's reliable evidence. You don't know if the police did the job the way they're supposed to do it. And if you don't have that advocate, the rest of the system can really break down.
And that's really what you see happen, why the problem with, say, jailhouse snitches has become something that is a concern is because you have so many of these situations where they were used, they weren't challenged, and hindsight being 2020, you see some of these cases unraveling now where a jailhouse snitch was used. And what's the reason that it got that far? And that's because no one was there really kind of trying to crack this thing back when it started.
Well, let's talk about that because this is another thing that you looked at is that a number of the cases, again, of these men who were exonerated involved evidence or testimony that were given by guys who were in jail for other crimes, clearly because they hoped that their testimony would benefit them somehow. And right on the face of that, that would make you question anything that they said. You'd say, well, okay, what's in it for these guys to be giving this information? And yet that information provided by them in a number of cases proved to be very important for the prosecution and for the conviction.
Right. I mean, a jailhouse snitch's credibility is questionable from the start. They've got something to gain if they testify the way the state wants them to. And it's a world away from somebody who sees something on the street and really is impartial, has no vested interest in the case. They do, and it's very, very difficult to trust what they say.
And that's why the idea to allow the pretrial deposition or taking of testimony from witnesses by either side, but particularly in a jailhouse snitch situation where before you even get to the point where you're on trial, a judge is going to make a determination of some credibility. That's a very, very important change to have in the system because it gets, for the defense, it allows them to have this opportunity to put someone through their paces, so to speak, in front of a judge and have some initial determination of whether this person has at least passes the initial threshold test of having, breathing human being that can put two thoughts together that looks like they have some sense of understanding the difference between a lie and the truth and, from there it goes.
In those cases where, to the extent that you know the answer to the question, in those cases where jailhouse testimony by the jailhouse snitch was used, did the defense lawyer not raise the issue of the credibility of the witness? Did the judge say, well, information about the background of this person and who they are and why they're in jail, we're not going to allow you to tell that to the jury? Or, you know, what were some of the circumstances surrounding that?
That's often brought out. But when a jury hears it, and we talk to a lot of jurors in doing our research, they're not always able to sort of sort out all the issues. And at times, the jailhouse snitch will deny that they're getting anything from further their testimony. They'll say, this is just, you know, the goodness of my heart. I want to do the right thing. And you don't know if they've been fed a line, if they're getting something, you know, maybe 6 months down the line, or if perhaps their family is getting a deal in some way. Maybe they've got, you know, a son or daughter who's in the system, and they're going to get a break. It's often not that clear where the break is going to come, if there is one.
And if you actually are aware, first of all, you are aware as a defense lawyer that this person is a prospective witness, and if you actually do some investigative work, you're sometimes able to crack through this and find something. But that it takes some tremendous digging on your part. And as a lawyer, are you going to do that, or are you going to have a private investigator do that? Private investigator takes money. I mean, some of this comes down to the almighty dollar.
Yeah.
In terms of when you're a defendant in a case, do you have the ability to pay? And how much do you think a good defense should in a capital case? I mean, there were cases that Steve and Ken Armstrong is a co-author on that series of people, you know, getting $7,000 to do a death penalty case.
Or less.
I mean, and that includes, you know, what should be considered in these cases, expert witnesses, investigation, private investigation, all the different costs that go into trial preparation. And by the time you come to trial, I mean, that money is, if you actually spent it, would be long gone.
Mm. Let me just reintroduce our guest real quickly here. We're talking with Maurice Posley and Steve Mills. They're both reporters for the Chicago Tribune, and over the past couple of years now, between them, they've done a lot of writing about the death penalty in Illinois, the mechanism of the death penalty, how capital cases are handled, some of the problems that have been cited, and they're here visiting the campus. They'll be talking with journalism students today. They'll be doing a brown bag today over at the College of Communications, and we're good enough to come a little earlier so they could come and spend some time talking with us. And, of course, your questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another issue and something that I think that you're going to be talking about later has to do with misconduct. Primarily, I think you were going to talk about prosecutors, but also there have been some questions raised about essentially about police misconduct. Another problem or set of problems that has been cited, coerced confessions, and also some coercion applied to witnesses to get them to say certain things that perhaps later they might say, well, no, I didn't really see that, or I didn't really know anything about it, but they leaned on me pretty hard, and so I said, yeah.
Well, yes, these are problems. The kind of the history of these series goes back to 1995 when Rolando Cruz was acquitted after his third death penalty trial. He had been convicted the first two times, and each time the cases were reversed and sent back. And in the course of that third trial, there was evidence developed that suggested for the first time that there may have been some shenanigans by prosecutors and detectives in that case aimed at framing the defendants. And it spawned a grand jury investigation, which resulted in the indictment of three former DuPage County prosecutors and four detectives. And for the first time, certainly in our part of the country, this had happened, that law enforcement, specifically prosecutors, were accused of framing someone. Mm-hmm. And it was a death row case in addition. So it started with an editor's question, how often does this happen? And the quick answer was, we don't know. And Ken Armstrong really is the one who began doing some digging, and it ultimately resulted in a series on prosecutors who cheat. examined murder cases across the country as well as specifically in Cook County, and found that it happens far more often than what people would anecdotally think, that prosecutors bend the rules to get convictions. Yeah. And it involves a whole wide variety of misconduct, some that occurs in the courtroom and some that occurs outside the courtroom, involving cutting deals and hiding evidence. And certainly as part of that, the issue of bad confessions comes up. Steve and I have worked on a case over the past year that's unfolded in Chicago where four men were convicted of the abduction, rape, and murder of a medical student back in 1986, and two of them confessed. The DNA has now come back, and it isn't these guys. So the question is, how is it that these two men, well, men, one was 14 at the time, came to give what police said was a confession to something that they didn't do? Yeah. And it does raise serious questions about police conduct.
Yeah, they're just in just today's paper. People want to look at it. There's a story about
right.
this.
We have a story today that talks about they finished the DNA tests on all the clothing. And here's something that's an example of when they decided to take another look at this case in terms of the DNA testing, they tested the clothes that were from the original evidence in which crime lab analyst from the Chicago Police Department had identified some semen stains. And that first round of tests came back and said, no, we've identified two DNA profiles in here, but it isn't any of these four guys. And so then out of an abundance of caution, the judge said, I want every piece of evidence in this case tested. And they came up with 22 more stains that had been overlooked or you pick your the verb you want to use, had not been found by that crime analyst back in 1986. Now, is that negligence? Is it sloppy work? I can't tell you what the answer is on that one. But, again, it's another example of perhaps if someone had been there to make these guys toe the line a little bit, some of this might have cracked back then.
I guess one of the things that leads one to wonder is that if there's misconduct by either police officers or by prosecutors, is it the case that they sincerely believe the person that has been charged is guilty, and this is a case of the end justifying the means? They say, well, look, this is a guy. This is the bad guy. This guy did it. I'm sure this guy did it, and we're going to put him away. Or it is, I suppose, the other extreme would be that they want to get a conviction, and one might wonder whether they care whether that person actually did it or not. They want to get somebody behind bars.
I think it's a little of both.
And I think in some cases, the motivations, you know, might be a little different. The case that we wrote about, the Rossetti case, was very high profile, a medical student from downstate in Chicago. And the pressure there was very high. It was a lot of media attention to the case. And so you can understand perhaps there's a motivation to push things very hard. Other cases, it's not clear why that would happen. You know, the sort of the garden variety murder that doesn't gain the same kind of attention. You know, what would be the motivation for somebody to do something like that? And I'm not sure what it would be. If it's just we need to clear cases.
I think there's a kind of a two-step process in some of this. I think that, yes, I agree with that, that in some cases police believe they got the right person and they want to make the evidence fit. Okay. Mm-hmm. And in some, I think it's just, as Steve said, they push really, really hard, too hard, and don't believe or don't take into account that they can put someone in a situation where they would be so despairing and beyond hope that they would actually feel that the best thing they can do is give a confession, even if they didn't do it. And then the police believe they've honestly solved it, and then it comes to the prosecutors, and they just take that case and push it because they believe that the police have the police told them we've got the right guy, and so what they're going to do is make the best possible case they can because it's their job to win.
You know, I think a lot of people wonder and this works in the Rossetti case, you know, how can somebody admit they did something if they didn't actually do it? I mean, if you put yourself in their shoes, you say, I would never do that. I would never confess to something I didn't do. But we've seen enough cases where the DNA shows us that that, in fact, did happen. And you have to wonder, well, then how did that happen? What were the pressures on that person? Were they simply weak, or was there just an inordinate amount of pressure put on them to get them to crack?
Yeah. One of the things that I think had been discussed as a result of the kind of reporting that you did was that there ought to be a better record made of questioning of suspects by police. And someone said, well, what we should do is require that all of these sessions be videotaped so that there would be a record. And I think police officers and prosecutors, a lot of people said, no, it's too complicated, it's too expensive, we don't have the money to do that. They really fought that on their side. Is there anything you think that has been suggested that might address this somewhat?
Well, the videotaping issue is interesting. It's the kind of thing that I think the culture of policing naturally resists. But the Chicago police now videotape the confession part, not the entire interrogation, but when the defendant confesses, if he's willing to do that. And it was something that police initially resisted and now find that, well, we've got a videotape statement. Nobody can get around that. It's very powerful. And there are some smaller departments, I believe Kankakee and maybe Kane County, where they do videotape the entire interrogation, and they find that it's not that difficult, that we can do this and it helps us in the courtroom, that people have seen enough TV, jurors have seen enough TV that they know that you'll say different things, you'll work different ways, and they can grasp what's going on in the interrogation room, and that it helps to seal a conviction, and it erases any sort of question that, you know, anything, you know, any of these shenanigans might have happened.
It's a befuddlement to me. I mean, I can understand the as Steve said, the culture and the mindset, but again, if we're doing this right, I mean, I really don't buy this money issue. Okay, I think we spend a lot of money. Taxpayers get billed for a lot of things, and that I don't think it would that it's an outrageous cost to think about to prevent what ultimately is costing us. $36 million was the tab for the Ford Heights 4 case when that one finally unraveled. Tell me how many videotaping operations and interrogations rooms you could do for $36 million, okay? It just seems to me that this idea that it's kind of like going to a restaurant and saying, I'd like to see how you cook the food. And if the guy says, I'm not going to let you in my kitchen because I'm afraid you won't eat here, then I'm not – it's the same kind of mindset. It's like, well, they're afraid. Are they afraid to let jurors or judges see the way they do their work because something bad's going to be there? Well, that's the implication from my perspective. Otherwise, what do you got to hide?
Yeah. Just going back to we talked a little bit about the fact that there was a commission that was appointed by the Supreme Court to look at the way that cases were handled, and that indeed this commission made some recommendations, and it mentioned that what they wanted to make certain was that attorneys that were representing people who were facing the death penalty were good, they were experienced, they would do a good job for their clients, and also that there would be some resources provided to address this other problem that we've talked about. That is, if you're going to hire expert witnesses, you're going to hire a private detective, you're going to do various kinds of forensic testing, it costs money, and if you don't have the money, you can't do it. Based on what you know and the cases that you've looked at, the kinds of changes that this commission has discussed, would they help?
They certainly will help. No doubt about it, the defense bar, the capital litigation bar, that'll certainly help. You'll get a more qualified level of attorney representing capital defendants. Some of the other things they're talking about as well, trying to gauge the reliability of a jailhouse snitch, that would help. But there's some things that I don't know that you'll ever get around. A lot of these cases unraveled simply because somebody came to court and lied. They didn't tell the truth. The police didn't do their job. The prosecutors didn't do their job. A witness lied. A defense lawyer lied and said that he had actually, done a full investigation when he hadn't. there's no way to get around sort of that malevolence, you know, in human nature. You can't legislate it. You can't, you know, have a Supreme Court rule. That's the part that'll be tricky.
I think that, you know, the whole DNA, emergence of DNA and the power it has to certainly to exonerate people is it's a great learning time for everyone. What it's taught us is that, that as great as our court system is or seems to be, that it's flawed, that it makes mistakes, that people are human, whether it is malevolent or whether it is innocent. Just pursuit of justice goes awry. The learning tool here is that we have to be more vigilant, and we have to be more vigilant at the time. And so the leveling of this playing field, I think, is going to help. The mere fact that it's happening in death penalty cases, that's great. I think it should be even go farther than that. You got people who are being sentenced to life in prison without parole. You get sentenced to 100 years in prison and even, you know, doing half of that, so you're going to spend 50 years. Or if you're under the new sentencing laws, you can do 80% or 85%, whatever it is. That's a slow death. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some people have said that the best thing that can happen to you now is to get sentenced to death because people pay attention to your case. If you get sentenced to life in prison without parole, you know, goodbye, good luck, and on to the next one.
Yeah. Well, how we've mentioned this figure, this the fact that since the death penalty came back in 1977, 12 executed, 13 exonerated. What would be your guess about the number of people? Say we just here we're talking about murder. The number of people who have been wrongly convicted. There must be some others. Is there any way?
Sure. I mean, look at these four guys in the Rossetti case. I mean, there's four guys convicted of murder. That's four right there. Ronald Jones.
He was a death case.
He was a death case.
We're working on cases right now where, you know, we are fairly confident that we have found innocent people who are doing either, you know, term of years or doing life.
If you said there's 100.
We've got a stack of, you know, other cases to look at still. I mean, we get letters all the time from inmates wanting us to look at their cases. There are a very good number of them where just even, you know, some cursory investigation tells you that something is wrong. Putting a number on it, though, I think that's
Yeah, how do you do it? I mean, if you said 100 people were convicted of murder in Cook County and in, say, you know, 2001, could I say five? I mean, it would be a pure guess. If somebody said how many from 1988, which is when these four guys actually went to trial, or in fact, one of them pleaded guilty, but three of them went to trial in the Rossetti case. If you said in 1988 and we had, you know, 500 people convicted of murder, whatever the figure is, and you said five of them, well, would people say you're crazy? I mean, here's four. And so who knows? I think that to say there's none is naive.
A little bit past the midpoint here. We have a caller. We'll get right to our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Maurice Bosley and Steve Mills. They're both reporters for the Chicago Tribune. Have done a lot of writing about the death penalty here in the state of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County. It's line one. Hello.
Hi, I have a series of general things that I'd maybe like to share. We haven't had a caller yet, but maybe the J School student will call in shortly about how you actually managed to write these stories. But how can a jailhouse snitch or an informant out of a jailhouse who says that I heard this guy, or this guy told me he did it, how can that have any credibility at all anyway? I think that ought to be barred just as a matter of course. I mean, we have... It just doesn't make any sense to me. One of the notorious death penalty cases, Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the main evidence, testimonial evidence, is a prostitute who got all of her prior infractions forgiven or something to that effect. Just doesn't seem like that would be very corroborating.
Well, in fact, I'm sure there are some jailhouse snitches who tell the truth. I mean, you know, you're locked up. People do talk about their cases, and I'm sure that a number of people do admit that they did what they're accused of. But sorting out the ones that did that when everybody is sort of starting from a base level of low credibility is difficult. A number of inmates often will have their legal papers in their cell, and a number of times, you know, they've accused their cellmate or somebody else of coming in and looking at them, and that's where they get their information. You know, I think one of the first things that a lawyer will tell a guy when he's arrested and goes to jail is, you know, keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything to anybody. Whether everybody listens to that or not, I don't know.
Well, I didn't think of this scenario to just now, but what if a guy was accused of murder and he didn't want to be bothered in jail, as we have lots of evidence of that happening, and the guy's going to say, sure, I did it. You know, don't mess with me. You know, I just, that's off the top of my head, but I don't know if we have this sort of this culture of prosecution and all of these many different things. It's sort of, you need a catalog of how many different ways these things can be made, whether it's in a non-death penalty case where you're you don't even go to trial, you just, people cop a plea. You know, there's so many precedents of that. In fact, I don't know how well statistics are even compiled when you start getting into that. I wanted to ask what kind of impact you think this situation in Illinois is having in other states, and said that you seem to have actually done some investigating in other states.
We've done a couple. After the Illinois series, we did a series in Texas, and then we did another series that looked at all of the executions since the law came back around the country. And the effect has been pretty startling, actually. A number of states have begun studies of their capital punishment system. One state, New Hampshire, I think it was, actually voted to end it, but the governor vetoed it, and they didn't even have anybody on death row. Texas instituted a number of reforms, and other states have done the same thing. So it's had its... I think it reignited this sort of dormant debate in the country. The death penalty had sort of fallen off the screen a bit, and I think this got people talking about it again. The federal government has looked at reforms as well. I think it became an issue again, and it still is one, and changing in some different ways.
This Illinois still remains the only state that's done what Governor Ryan did and imposed this moratorium. But the fact that you had, I think, something like 15 states, moratorium bills were introduced in the legislature. And while they didn't pass, the mere fact that they were even introduced in some states, I mean, there was one introduced in Texas, and you knew where that was, how far south that was going in a relatively short period of time. But the mere fact that people are doing this kind of thing, it's raised the consciousness level. A number of states have now banned the execution of the mentally retarded just in the past year. And, of course, that is an issue that the Supreme Court is going to readdress next year.
And they've also, some states have been discussing banning the execution of juveniles or offenders who commit their crimes when they're juveniles. So it's
piecemeal, but I think what's happened just in the last 2.5 years is pretty startling in the history when you go back to 76 when it came back in the country.
You were talking earlier about the recording of confessions. I believe in Illinois, I don't know how the overall bill fared, but wasn't it broken out that there would be at least a videotaping of juvenile confessions or interrogations?
There was a bill, and that
didn't make it either.
No.
Well, it's that's distressing. Just one last, and this is maybe a gratuitous comment, but we have a judge from this district who is running for the Supreme Court, and I guess I'll say his name, Steigman, who believes that Ryan's moratorium was illegal. And he said this on call-in shows. And
he's not the only one.
Well.
Right, he's not the only one who says that.
It seems to me, I thought there were, I don't know if it's common law basis that it's argued that I guess they would argue that he could commute them all, but he couldn't put them in moratorium or something like that. It just seems outrageous when you have the statistic of, you know, half of the people were erroneously sentenced, that you have judges and other people saying that it was wrong to establish a moratorium. All right, I think I'm going to go red here. And
all right. Well, thanks for the call. We have somebody else here in Chicago, and we'll get to them in just a second. Just to come back for a moment to the moratorium. It's still in place, and I believe what the governor said was that he was going to leave it there until the commission that he set up came back with some recommendation.
Right.
Is there any word on when that might happen?
After the first of the year is what I'm hearing.
And before the primary?
When's the primary?
March, I guess. Right?
Possibly. Yeah. I think they set a pretty tall order for themselves. They've done a lot of research, and I think they've been really working through it. You know,
how many
others,
shots do you get at this? So I think they're going to do it. Try and do it right.
Yeah. A lot of the other committees didn't sort of do the research that you might have hoped that they would have done, and that was actually one of the things that sparked our work. But this, the governor's commission has done an extraordinary amount of work, from what I understand. And I think, as Maury said, you know, you've probably got one good shot at this, and they want to do their job right.
Do you think that the death penalty is likely to be an issue in the race for governor?
Well, I think it could be. I mean, you know, referring to the caller's comment there, this business about that it's illegal. You know, my response to that is they should put their money where their mouth is. If it's illegal, do something about it. It's at this point, I think, political rhetoric. It's a way of kind of raising the issue in a way, a different way than coming out and saying, I just want to kill people. I think we should be allowed to kill people who commit crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, will it be? It's a little bit of a hot potato.
Yeah. So it seems to me that the comments that I've seen about the people from people who are running are basically all the same. They sort of run along the lines that says, yes, we think that there are some problems with the system, but we think that they can be fixed, and candidate X, still believe in the death penalty. So nobody who's running has said anything that would make it sound like they're even nudging close to saying, well, maybe we should question the whole idea of capital punishment.
That's true. But that may at some point change. Virginia, a state that has been as supportive of the death penalty as any state, recently elected a lieutenant governor who opposes the death penalty, which was pretty startling. So maybe somebody in Illinois will come out with that point of view as well, although nobody has yet, I don't think.
I think that's one of the things that's changed or is changing a little bit in this country that is not considered quite, and I don't mean no pun intended, but a death knell to your campaign to say, I don't think we should kill people for committing crimes. I don't think it has quite the baggage across the board as a general statement that it did, say, 4 years ago.
Here's another caller in Chicago, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
What I've heard this morning is all fine, but it seems to me you're not getting at the basic, or at least a basic, cause of these false convictions, and that is the public itself. The public elects these prosecutors, very ambitious prosecutors, who tend to be crooked, and they don't look at the qualifications of the prosecutors, except that the prosecutors give them a lot of baloney, and they believe it. Same goes for governors. Many of these prosecutors become governors, and they remain crooked all the way through. We've had a number of governors who were crooked, and the public never catches on. Have you done any research or any articles that would point a finger at the way the public votes and selects its office holders and that sort of thing, which might have a decent effect?
First, I don't know that every prosecutor is crooked or any of them have been crooked necessarily. But no, we haven't done that kind of research yet. And I don't know that we necessarily will.
In terms of the public response, I think one of the things that contributes to the lack maybe of a public getting really upset with a particular individual, whether it's a prosecutor or a judge or a police officer, is that and the Rossetti case is a perfect example. It takes a long time. These cases don't blow up right almost in the inception. And cases that perhaps are now going to be caught in the early stages, we may never know about. because it just we won't get in that situation of convicting the wrong person. But the Rossetti case now, you know, these guys got convicted in 88, so here we are 13 years later, and the case is unraveling. So who do you point the finger at?
Well, can I interrupt?
Sure.
Seems to me you don't have to go after cases as far as researching how the public votes. That you can go to any issue or just a general situation and how the public votes and the types of candidates that it elects. Most candidates lie all the time, but they leave a track record, and it is possible to see whether this guy who is a candidate has a good chance of being a decent office holder and one who doesn't. To give as an instance, if you recall, Clinton made a speech before the Democratic National Convention about 8 years before he was a candidate or was nominated, 4 years or 8 years, and the speech was a terrible one. On that basis, I wouldn't have chosen him to be a candidate for the door catcher. And as it turned out, he was miserable all in all, even though I voted for him. I thought he was better than any alternative.
Let me just jump in here because, again, I apologize to the caller because we're getting kind of short on time. And get back to the—I think it was Maurice Bosley who said that, you know, maybe we're getting to the point where it's not necessarily— people are maybe are willing, a candidate might be willing to say, I'm not so sure I believe in the death penalty. But it seems that you can't lose, it won't hurt you if you say, I believe on being tough on crime and I'm for the death penalty. Do we have any reason to believe that more than anything else a candidate might say is really going to resonate with voters, and that if you decided that was you were going to adopt that as a strategy, you were going to be a law and order candidate, it was going to be all about being tough, and you were going to be absolutely behind capital punishment, whether that's really going to be so advantageous that people will grab onto that as opposed to anything else that you might say?
I think being, you know, tough on crime is a pretty safe strategy, and it's proved the test of time to be fairly successful. But what we've seen since the moratorium raises a few questions about that. In one case, support for the death penalty across the country and in Illinois has dropped fairly substantially, and it had remained steady for a number of years. Support for the moratorium has been very high. I think it was close to two-thirds or three-quarters, maybe, support for the moratorium. And I think that shows that you might be able to go different ways, and that voters maybe understand some of the more complex issues, that they read enough stories and heard enough cases where the justice system hadn't worked properly, and that they knew that there was a problem that needed to be addressed.
I think the public may be, or is in some sense, coming to the point where to say that I don't support the death penalty does not automatically convert to I'm soft on crime, that you can be hard on criminals and believe in a tough stance on crime and still countenance the fact that you just don't think that there's a point in killing them, whether it's a moral view or whether it's an economic view. I mean, there's been plenty of research done that shows how expensive it is to kill somebody because of the nature of the appeals process and how long it takes. And, you know, thank goodness for some of these people that it did take a long time or they'd be dead. Yeah. And they would have killed the wrong people.
Many years ago, at this point, it might be 7 years ago or something, when Jim Edgar was governor, I was interviewing him. And I was interested in sort of teasing at that very point. And I asked him a question like, well, we're talking about capital punishment. I said, well, what is support for the death penalty got to do with effective, law enforcement and going effectively after crime? And he looked at me like I was nuts. And he just sort of stopped, and he said, are you serious? And I
right.
said, yes, Governor, I actually am. And he went on to try to make the argument, well, of course, sort of attacking the point that you made, that, yeah, being for the death penalty means being tough on crime, and if you're not for the death penalty, that must be means
well,
that you're
you know,
soft on crime.
Edgar had a point, though. In other states where political campaigns and judicial campaigns are run differently, candidates for the bench and for the governor's office have run on that very issue. I will execute people or more people, or I'll execute them faster than my opponent will. It's a very real issue in other states. And, you know, I will not allow these frivolous appeals, no matter what it is. That's a very real issue. I mean, he hit on something, and I think he knew what he was talking about, that for a lot of people, it's sort of the, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, I'll extend the term for robbery from 20 to 30 years. That doesn't really resonate. What does resonate is, you know, I will support the death penalty, and we will do it. We won't have these people in prison for 15, 20, 25 years.
We're almost out of time. I have several callers. I'm not going to be able to take them all. My apologies. We'll try and get at least one more here. Let's go to Terre Haute in Indiana, line two. Hello.
Yes, concerning the fact that DNA, it seems to be the primary way of disproving case, you know, cases nowadays. The thing I, from what information I've been able to get, is like to say there's 30 billion parts to the DNA, and if you get a 3 or 4 pieces identification, that says that guy did this thing. That, and you know, just the mathematical deal of you only using 3 or 4 parts out of 30 billion seems like to me that's not a very good test.
Well, actually, I can't explain the whole science of it to you, but the way they do it is in a way that it can distinguish between individuals, and it isn't just like 3 or 4 points that they do.
It's a little more complex.
They run
than
it
that,
out. They do run it out in a long string.
So there's no doubt that it really does work. And that it's sound, and you can make the argument that if you have evidence, you linking, you know, evidence from a crime scene, that you really can say this person over here could not have done it, but this person over here, we think is the person that did it.
They wouldn't be letting people off death row if they didn't believe that it was exact, that it was an exact science. They just wouldn't. You wouldn't get prosecutors and judges doing it.
Well, we're at the point we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take, but we'll have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say very much thanks to Maurice Posley, Steve Mills, reporters for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.